Thanks for tuning in and welcome to the September 2nd Labor Day edition of IMRU Radio Magazine. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones. Tonight we salute Labor Day with an encore of Dan Guerrero's very special Gaytina Report visit with iconic Latino labor movement leader Dolores Huerta.
And keeping things in a Labor Day theme, I'll share my Labor of Love visit with celebrated UK singer-songwriter Holly Lursky.
But first, the honest tea, and let me take advantage of this opportunity to wish you a happy post-straight Pride Day, Abby.
Thank you, Wenzel.
They did go off, one in Boston, one in Modesto.
Wait, yeah, and so what's the final verdict here?
Hardly anybody showed up.
Yeah, like 20 people in Modesto?
Yeah, I think there were more people there to see if anybody showed up than actually participated.
And then Boston. I mean, Modesto,
yeah.
20 people. Okay, that sounds about right. But Boston,
I know.
Also had like 20 people.
That's not even a full Starbucks.
And apparently both events ended up becoming sort of ersatz LGBT pride events, which just goes to show that we always make things better. We make things more interesting, loving, and enjoyable. Even your damn straight pride parade.
We had the sparkle. Although there was a delightful moment when Don Grundman up in Modesto, he leads the National Straight Pride Coalition. He got up before the City of Modesto Council and he was giving a speech and he referred to their organization as a totally peaceful racist group. He didn't mean to say that. But that's what came out.
There have been a lot of these stories of people, whoops, accidentally saying they're racist. Like, yeah, we kind of knew. But thank you for confirming that. And that's really about all the energy I want to give Stripe Pride.
I've got nothing more left either. Okay.
Yeah. So moving on to real issues.
Ooh, this one scared me.
Flying while trans.
Yeah.
LGBTQNation.com published a story about just how fraught and invasive going through airport security is for many trans people. Here's an example they gave. In 2017, a trans woman named Olivia was flagged after going through a TSA scanner. The operator hit the pink button, which is pink for girls.
See, this I did not know.
That they actually hit a button that says boy or girl.
Yeah, somebody sits there and judges what they think you are by the way you're presenting. They
before
hit
you
the
go in.
Yeah, and this is done in half a second. And if they hit the blue button, it especially scans your genitals looking for a penis. And if they hit the pink button, it specifically scans for breasts.
That's how that works.
I did not know of the existence of the buttons. I thought we all got the same intrusive scan.
And apparently it causes problems even for the TSA personnel who have to make a gender judgment call in a split second. And obviously things go wrong. Olivia, they hit pink for girls, and the scanner noticed something in her crotch that wasn't supposed to be there in their algorithm for whatever a girl is.
Right.
And so it was Olivia's penis. They pat her down, and she immediately said, I'll tell you what this is. And that was not enough. They had to take her to a private room.
Right.
She was there with three officers. She said, listen, I'll just show you, the three female officers. They said, nope. Supervisor said male officers had to pat her down because it was a penis.
But they could only pat her down. She's not supposed to show them.
Eventually, she did actually show them because it was the only way she could get on the flight. What they wanted was a group of men to be there to pat her down, which is actually against TSA policy, which says you should be patted down by your of your gender identity.
Right.
But she wanted to get on the plane. She showed them a group of TSA officers in a room, including men. She had to basically drop trowel and show them and then got on her plane and she was traumatized. But this story is not unusual.
The thing about TSA to me, though, is it has always just been really poorly produced theater of fear. It's there to keep you scared and make them seem necessary. I don't think they're actually accomplishing much of anything except making sure people are terrified when they fly.
Yeah, misgendered and forced to be felt up and everything else.
Yeah.
And it really sounds like TSA is aware of this problem. The big issue is they have huge turnaround. They're a huge organization and they have major turnaround. So even if they do have policies in place and trainings, it's not enough. This is still happening. So ProPublica reviewed complaints in the last couple of years and they said that 5% of all the TSA complaints that were publicly available to them were about screenings of trans people who experienced problems. And those were just the people who complained.
Right. And I guess that the percentage of trans travelers is really closer to 1%. So they're disproportionately, you know, represented. Those are just the people who reported, because as with so many other crimes against people, there is this element of shame attached to it, or discomfort, or you don't want to relive it, and so you just don't tell anybody.
A 2015 survey confirmed that fact, that 43% of trans flyers reported having problems with security. I mean, the most personal problems. Yeah. And 50% of trans people reported that they were hesitant to talk to law enforcement. So obviously, this is being underreported. And TSA does admit that they have known about this problem since the beginning of this technology, which was 2010. Mm-hmm. And there have been problems with people with disabilities, people with religious head coverings, women of color whose hairstyles often trigger the body scanners because it doesn't fit whatever this button says a girl or a boy is supposed to look like. Cisgender women with baggy clothes. I'm thinking of people with prosthetic breasts and things like that. LGBTQ Nation also raised the question about any recourse that trans people have about this, because of the rollback of the anti-discrimination protections for trans people, the little bit that we had.
Because there were so many on the books.
Yeah, I know. And now they are, the few that we had are being removed. But couple of bottom lines here, just for people to know. TSA is not supposed to ask people to remove their clothing and show their naked bits. It happens, but they are not supposed to. They are supposed to provide pat-downs by officers that match the gender identity of the traveler, and you are allowed to have a witness there.
Know before you fly.
Yeah.
And that's true, because I guess Olivia is in fact a lawyer and was unaware because she was traveling with her fiancé at the time and did not know that she could have brought the fiancé into the room as a witness with a TSA agent.
And it may not have changed things,
no,
but just the sense that you are not alone in there.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I get really caught up in the how hard is this to create a technology that can deal with a more expanded concept of gender. Are you going
That's
to
true.
Hide a bomb that looks like breasts or a penis?
Again, my whole issue with the TSA is much deeper than that.
I'm also just struck by how often these things get boiled down to issues of our parts.
Right.
Which is so reductive, it makes me crazy.
It is.
Anyway, TSA has started some 30-minute mandatory online training about this that is not going over terribly well, because first of all, come on, 30 minutes?
Online?
Online, and even the TSA officers are saying this is ridiculous. I mean, they're saying it's ridiculous because they think the whole issue is ridiculous, that they should even be thoughtful about this. Some of them are saying
that. That's true.
And others are saying, come on, 30 minutes is not enough, and recognizing that more needs to be done and the technology needs to be improved.
Although part of me would love to see that training video, because I remember when I had a job and we had the online sexual harassment training video, and we would then perform highlights from it later because it was so ridiculously done. It was so bad.
And TSA is not releasing the materials they're using for this training, so I suspect this thing might be ripe for performance.
Yeah.
Somebody, one of the people featured in this article actually had the suggestion of going to the TSA website when you fly, and this applies to everybody, I think, and copying their rules so you have it to refer to if something happens. And that's tsa.gov. You can get them on that website. Yeah.
It's probably good to know the rules anyway.
Yes.
Because it's so easy in a situation like that to just sign away your agency. Whatever, just get me through here.
Like you said, the whole system is designed to intimidate.
Yeah, and it does.
And it does.
Okay, that's it for the handsy TSA agents.
Yes, so.
Now, handsy bouncers here in LA.
Yeah.
At the LA Bar Las Perlas downtown, there was a situation where there was a group of trans women out, and I think they're from Bienestar, which
is a wonderful organization that deals with healthcare issues in Latinx and LGBT communities.
So they were out at Las Perlas, and this straight couple came up and started harassing them and saying, "You're not really girls, you're guys." And the bouncers then dragged the women out, the trans women out from Bienestar.
Yeah. And forcibly, and there is video of this,
which you
can see, in a headlock,
shoving.
And the women reported that the couple that was harassing them was actually making death threats and spitting at them. It was that bad, but that they were asked to leave very politely. And the bar owners sort of took the public position that we took all sides of the conflict out of the bar. And I'm thinking, wait, you took the people that were being threatened and also sent them outside beyond the fact that they were manhandled. I would say put them at risk by doing that.
Here's our little sidebar. In the New York Times Sunday Magazine, there's a little teeny tiny thing called how to, you know, how to build a sandcastle. And just a couple weeks ago, it was how to be a bouncer. And it said, you don't have to be the biggest man in the room. You don't even have to be a man. But a bouncer's job is to see the situation and diffuse the situation.
And see who is the victim, I'm thinking, right. And who is the perpetrator.
Right. And my boyfriend, the person everybody thinks I make up, he used to be a bouncer. And we talked about it because he says, yeah, he was a really good bouncer because he would see. And basically, you just take the person who's causing the trouble, buy him a drink and take him out the door. And before they know it, they're outside the door. And then it's not your problem anymore.
Yeah. Well, Las Perlas.
Yeah.
To their credit, they have kind of belatedly realized that their people handled this very poorly.
Right.
But this was after a demonstration of at least a few dozen people the next night at the bar where they closed it inexplicably. And they still were kind of using this both sides language, which, as we know, is a little loaded right now. They have apologized to the transgender community, and they said that the security company working the bar would be replaced and that they would donate the profits from that weekend, which was the downtown LA Pride weekend, to Being a Star. But really, the sense is that it's not enough, and their motives are being questioned because it took a long time, and they're trying to open a new branch in West Hollywood.
I know. Yeah, I guess the paperwork isn't finished with that yet, but...
I mean, what I see in this is how discrimination works. It's not people twiddling their evil mustaches. It's people seeing something happening and not seeing themselves in a victim.
Right.
Othering the victim and then being able to just sort of go, well, you're the weirdos here. You're out.
I didn't notice, and it's a very small video, so it's not really like being there, but I didn't notice that other patrons in the bar were standing up for anybody.
No, but the other folks from Being a Star did actually try to surround the women and protect them, and that failed. So, okay, there are some little bits of good news here. Here is the moment where Wenzel and I talk sports.
Sports, which is a foreign language to both of us, so let's see how we
do. I hear tell that sports are very important in this country, and the NFL.
They are, and there is a football player, Ryan Russell. He's no longer with the NFL because he had been injured, but he used to play with Dallas in 15 and with Tampa in 16 and 17. But he has come out as bisexual, and he now wants to rejoin the NFL as the only LGBTQ person in the NFL. But there are no out people in the NHL, in professional baseball.
And many people have come out after they've retired. But he's unusual because he wants to go in, and he wrote, I guess, an op-ed on ESPN.com where he talked about his whole process and basically said, I want to be an authentic person and have all my parts together, and that shouldn't be a big ask.
Right.
And he said the NFL has a huge PR team that can deal with this.
And because we don't speak sports, I don't remember his name, but there was the out football player. Did he never get picked up for a team, or he got picked up and
was
dropped?
It Michael Sam?
Michael Sam, yeah.
And then he ended up with the Canadian football Alouettes.
Alouette. I love the idea that he's a football player.
Yeah, Alouette. It's so Canadian.
No. So as it stands, there are no out people in those professional sports that we were talking about. And Ryan O'Callaghan, who was a football player, left football, then came out and wrote a book.
But this is a first.
Yeah.
And he knows it.
Yeah. But he was saying there is pretty much at least one LGBTQ person on every team.
Yeah. He said that he wasn't out for a while because he is bi, and he thought maybe he'd settle down with a woman and it would be not an issue. Then
we're back to Ryan Russell now.
Going back to him. And it really made me think, though, about this horrible thing that we do to bi people, which is when bi people are with someone of the opposite sex, we strip them of their queerness. And probably there is an internalized biphobia in which they attempt to strip themselves of their queerness. And that's sort of an example.
I know, just the idea that he was with a woman, so he felt no need to come out as bi.
And he realized that that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
He also described himself not only as a good football player, but as a writer. And he said that since he's not been playing and healing his shoulder, he's been writing the stories he wished he'd read as a little boy.
Oh.
And that, I thought, well, he didn't say any more about that, but I'd like to know what those stories are. He seems like a very interesting, thoughtful guy. So I want to see how he does. I hope that his optimism is well-founded.
I hope these stories are a hit at Drag Queen Story Hour.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it sounds like it'll be those kind of stories.
Yes. And just a last little note, the country of Thailand looks like it might be slated to be the first Southeast Asian country to legalize same-sex unions. Not marriage,
not
but
marriage,
unions.
Yeah. But Southeast Asia, because Taiwan already has...
They passed same-sex unions in May, so right. They are the first Asian country.
Right.
So Thailand would be the second Asian country and the first Southeast Asian country.
Right.
And what's interesting about this is that both sides in parliament are supporting the core ideals of this. Mm-hmm. And the opposition to this bill is actually coming from people like us, LGBTQ activists who say it's not enough. We need to degender our law.
Right.
My sense is that they are pushing for a bigger conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But when this thing comes down to a vote next year, it looks like there's a lot of support all across the board.
Well, and also the parliament, which I guess has an 80-year history, this is the first time there have been out LGBTQ people sitting in parliament.
Yeah.
The first time.
They're moving forward.
Exactly. And we're
moving backwards.
Moving back.
But I want to keep highlighting the moving forward.
Okay. Let's do that.
All right.
Okay. And that was The Honest Tea.
Pick a pseudonym coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. In the past, gays and lesbians have used pseudonyms to help disguise their sexual orientation because of fear of arrest and persecution. Some early homophile organizations required their members to use pseudonyms even if they were out. An early lesbian magazine called The Ladder was first published in October 1956 by editor Phyllis Lyon. She used the name Ann Ferguson. When activist Jack Nichols appeared in TV in the 1967 CBS documentary The Homosexual, he used the name Warren Atkins and did so at the request of his father, who was an FBI agent. Back in June 1947, 25-year-old Edith Ide published the first lesbian publication in North America called Vice Versa. She later wrote for the latter under the pseudonym Lisa Benn, which was an anagram for lesbian. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me. I'm Dan Roberts.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City. IMRU Radio Magazine has been the voice of the LGBT community in Southern California since 1974.
Here's my heart, wrapped and bound, sent with all of my love, if you'd only come sit down. Darling, here's my head, filled with doubt, but I'll try to say this to you, if you'd only hear me out. Oh, darling, that if you stay tonight, we might change the course of our history, bend the laws, defy the cosmos, wind up in a different story. And if you stay tonight, there's a chance in a million you might begin something good. Here's my word, I will give you now, that I promise to say all this to you, if you'd only hear me out. Oh, darling, that if you stay tonight, we might change the course of our history, bend the laws and defy the cosmos, wind up in a different story. And if you stay tonight, there's a chance in a million you might begin something good tonight. Now it's time to say this to you, if you'd only come sit down.
Welcome back. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
That song coming out of break was Come Sit Down by singer-songwriter Holly Lursky, who I'll be talking to later in the show. And now, to honor Labor Day, an encore of a very special Gaytino report and Dan's visit with 89-year-old labor leader and civil rights activist Dolores Huerta.
In the 1960s, she co-founded the National Farm Workers Association, which later became the United Farm Workers, with Cesar Chavez.
Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Gaytino Report. Voices from the Latino LGBTQ community. I'm Dan Guerrero, or if you can roll your R's, Guerrero. And welcome to my very special guest, an American hero, my personal hero, a woman on a lifelong journey as a community organizer and social justice activist. Dolores Huerta has been an iconic civil rights leader for more than 50 years and still going strong. Most know she co-founded with Cesar Chavez the United Farm Workers Union. Some may not know Dolores has long been a champion for the LGBTQ community, a community that supported Dolores and Cesar in the earliest and most dangerous days of the UFW. Welcome, Dolores. Thank you so much for being on the Gaytino Report.
Oh, I love it.
Did we ever think we'd see a day when we have a radio show called the Gaytino?
Well, I'm sure that on this station, it's definitely possible.
It is possible. I'm very happy to be doing this show and to be putting the spotlight on the Latino LGBTQ community. Now, we've been friends for a long time, I'm very proud to say, and we've talked about many, many things, but it was only recently that we started to talk about the LGBTQ issue in our community, and that came about because of that story Luis Valdez told me about the People's Bar. Do you remember the People's Bar?
Oh, of course.
The LGBT community was very much supportive of you and Cesar back when you first were starting the UFW. And in those most dangerous days, they would march right alongside you.
We actually had a special button designed for our support LGBT community. And it was the farm worker eagle with the pink triangle. And actually, when we were on the boycott in 1968, many of our staff members were involved in the big marches that they had in the Stonewall marches back there in New York City. And then over the years, we always participated in the marches, gay pride marches here in West Hollywood and also in San Francisco. And it was wonderful because it would be great to see all the farm workers coming down with their flags. And I remember one farm worker saying to me in Spanish, "Ay, señora Huerta, esta gente nos quiere mucho." In English, he said, "Huerta," he said, "these people really love us." And I said, "Yes, they do. And they're very supportive of us." And so the farm workers just marched with so much pride in the gay pride march. So it was just wonderful to see that.
But getting back to the People's Bar, I was so amazed by that story. According to Luis, it was a bar owned by a lesbian woman, I believe Mocha. And after the marches and rallies and all that, the campesinos and you and Cesar would all go back and there'd be the gay community there hanging out at a lesbian bar. I think that's a movie scene.
Well, it's more than that. Mocha was actually Cesar's and Helen Chavez Cesar's wife, their comadre, because she baptized Caesar's oldest son, Fernando Chavez. And we had actually many of the strikers, we had a large component of gays that were part of the farm worker movement. Many of them worked at the DiGiorgio Ranch, which is one of the big companies that we were striking at that time. In fact, they were the object of one of our big boycotts that we had.
I know with the immigration issue, so I don't even know what to say, such a hot button issue. And for LGBT undocumented men and women, that's an additional challenge. I mean, it's a whole other ball game for them when you're undocumented.
Yeah, and it's really bad because we have many of our LGBT community who have their partners or the people that they have married who are undocumented, and they have a kind of a really, really big problem in terms of being able to fix their papers so that they can come over and join their spouses. So it is a very, very big issue, a very painful one.
Painful, yes, that's the right word. And also in terms of health, because if they're undocumented, they're afraid to go get tested for AIDS, and it's a domino effect in so many areas for the undocumented gay man or woman.
Well, I think in terms of testing, like we participate in that. One of my son-in-laws, Camilla's husband, he has, been, but what we have done when we do the testing is we actually take it out to the street. is what we do in Kern County. We just don't wait for people to come to us. And we have a very active program there every single year to talk about the testing and do a lot of publicity
Your
around
foundation?
It. Yes. And we partner with other organizations to make this happen. But we don't wait for people to come to us. We go out there and look for them.
Can we talk about Juanita?
Yes, we can.
Well, I love Juanita. She's a pistol, that lady, isn't
she? Oh, she sure is.
Your daughter, Juanita Chavez. Mm-hmm. Did she come out to you early, or how did that all come about?
I think after she graduated from San Francisco State College, then she let everybody know that she had a partner. So she lived with her partner for a few years. Her partner eventually transitioned and became a man.
She's very active, and she calls herself an out and proud member of the LGBTQ community. She was a teacher for a good many years. And she co-founded the first Gay Straight Alliance at Mission High School, where she went. Was that in Bakersfield?
No, that was in San Francisco, right there in the Mission.
Oh, in the Mission District.
Yeah, she lived in San Francisco when she graduated from San Francisco State. Her first teaching job was at Mission High School. And she did more than that. She also created a clinic there and provided counseling services for the LGBT youth that were there at Mission High School.
She's currently the communications and media coordinator for the Dolores Huerta Foundation.
Yes.
This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaytino Report, and I'm talking to my very special guest, Dolores Huerta.
It's like you're going to go on forever doing this. It's such a marvel to see, and how you embrace so many of these, I don't know, I hate to call them causes, but I don't know what else to call
them,
and how they intersect each other.
Right. Well, it's a human rights agenda, you know.
Yes.
It's about human rights.
Yes, that's the basic, that's the bottom line.
What it's all about. And I was very fortunate, you know, I knew Harvey Milk. We campaigned for him when he ran for the Board of Supervisors. He was a very good friend of Caesar's and a good friend of Richard Chavez, Juanita's dad. So it's always been a very, very strong connection. People sometimes ask me, where did this evolve from? I said, well, I don't know. It's always been there. I can't ever remember a time when I remember going to Mexico when I was a teenager. I was 17 years old. And it was really interesting there because there were some gay waiters in this restaurant. And my stepfather was from Mexico City. And he said in Spanish, estos son los Luisitos. He said, those are, they call them Luis. And I said, what is that? What is that? He said, these are gay men. And he said, everybody has to protect them to make sure they're not harmed. And I thought, oh, that's such a beautiful sentiment. My stepfather was born in Mexico City, grew up in Mexico City. He was kind of from the middle class. And it's interesting, and then we saw how that changed later on. I really don't know the history there. I guess somebody from Mexico could say that. It may have been when, and I don't know when Fox became president or wherever, when they kind of reconnected with the Catholic Church again. So I don't know, but something happened there from the time I was 17. And of course, later on, we saw a lot of discrimination in Mexico. But it's interesting, too, that the Oaxacans, you know, they have a very different take on gender. There's a third gender, and the third gender are people that are very sacred, actually. And they have a wonderful celebration here in Los Angeles. I think it's called Los Mochis. And people dress up in the Tijuana, which is part of the Tijuanas, these beautiful, beautiful costumes where they have the huge lace bonnets and these beautiful embroidered costumes with these huge embroidered skirts. And they have a beautiful celebration here in Los Angeles. And they every year they elect a queen. And it is a person from the third gender that is the queen. It's a beautiful celebration. I wasn't able to go this last year, but the year before last, and you had the Mexican consulate was there, and all of the local city officials were there. I think that there's a movie about this, and maybe we can have some of the folks that organize this beautiful
event. Yes,
I
would love. I never knew about this.
Yeah, well, in Oaxaca, it happens every year. But now in Los Angeles, they've been doing it for a few years.
Well, it sounds like the Native Americans here in what is now the United States, because they also revered, they were called Two Spirits.
Right.
And they revered them, and it was like they were special,
exactly.
You know, because they understood the two worlds. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, in Mexico City, going back a little bit, now, of course, gay marriage has been legal there for a good many years, and their gay pride is no longer the F, it's now Ciudad de Mexico, right? It's huge. They have a huge gay pride celebration there. So it has evolved there, which is fascinating to me, you know. We're getting some external noises because we are at the Catalina Bar and Grill, where Dolores Huerta has just been honored by KPFK, and for good reason. You've spoken very highly of KPFK, how it was the only voice in the early days of the movement.
Yes, absolutely. And this is such an incredible, incredible radio station. And what I love is we think of the many years now that this has been celebrated, this organization. I remember when it was first started, because I am, as you know, 87 years old now. So I was just lucky to be alive when so many of these great things were just beginning, like the radio station. And knew some of the first pioneers that started the radio station. I was very lucky to know some of them. And to know this, it's still here.
And you are too.
And yes, I'm lucky to be here, but the people are still supporting KPFK and KPFA.
You know who personifies the whole issue of undocumented people who are of the LGBT community is Jose Antonio Vargas. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of people know about him. He was born in the Philippines, mm-hmm. and it wasn't until he was about 16 that he found out he was undocumented, mm-hmm. and he's a gay man. Mm-hmm. And I guess he's got a book coming out, but he personifies that whole issue.
Yeah, and Jose has been, as you know, very active all over the United States. He travels a lot, and he has an organization called Define America. And his organization tends to try to educate people on issues of the gay and lesbian transgender community, but also very, very active just in terms of the Dreamers.
Have you worked together? Have you
met?
Yes,
we have. Yeah, Jose, we have been working together. But in fact, this last year, he was very active on helping us out with the film also, the film Dolores that was produced by Carlos Santana.
Your documentary.
Yes, the documentary.
Your documentary was fantastic. The film, Rosario Dawson playing you, I don't think so. But the documentary, I've seen it twice. It's incredible. How did you feel about it?
I was really happy that they found so much footage that I had never seen. And they touched on the issues, of course, of sexism, discrimination against women, the farm workers being victorious over Richard Nixon, the president of the United States, and Ronald Reagan. I want to just say a word about Ronald Reagan. Maybe some of our listeners are going to say, well, Ronald Reagan bought us amnesty. That didn't happen. He signed the law. The ones who did the work on that amnesty bill was Ted Kennedy, Schumer, who is now in the Senate. He was in the head of the Judiciary Committee, Howard Berman here in California, Peter Rodino. They were the main people. And myself, I'm going to include myself, because one of the things that we're trying to do now is make as women get credit for the work that we do, right? And I worked on the amnesty bill for months in Washington, D.C. to make sure that it passed. And so just remember, Reagan is not all that great. But the film, I think, is really great because it also touches on the issues of police brutality. It touches on ethnic studies, which we know in Arizona. And you and I were marching there in Arizona when they were doing all of that discrimination against the undocumented people, and also taking ethnic studies out of the schools, out of the high schools. As you may know, the state Supreme Court has now ruled that they have to teach ethnic studies. So they lost that law that they passed.
I did love that film so much, but I loved hearing from your children. Well, they're not children anymore, mm-hmm. but they're still your children, your babies, mm-hmm. right? It mm-hmm. was Juanita spoke, and I think Ricky. Mm-hmm. And it humanized you because mm-hmm. everyone knows you as the iconic figure that you are. Mm-hmm. But you're a lady with family, and mm-hmm. it was beautiful to see that side.
Mm-hmm. And Camila, who's the executive director of my foundation, she's the one that does all the work while I'm running around the country, following the film around and doing speaking engagements.
Your energy I remember one time we were at some event, and then I called you the next morning to, I don't know what, and you said, oh, I'm in Cleveland, and I'm going to speak in a minute. I'm thinking, Cleveland? We were in L.A. at 11 o'clock last night, and you were, I don't know how you do it. I honestly don't.
Well, we try to cover as much as we can because we want to get the message out there about the Dreamers. We want to get the message out about we want people to be sure and vote and go out and knock on doors and phone bank and get themselves elected. We're urging people, yes, run for the school board, run for the city council. We've got to get progressive people to take over the power. And of course, as we're talking about the issues of LGBT community, these are some of the things that we have to really work hard on, okay, so we can end the homophobia in our community and in our society. And I think we're on the way there. We're not there yet, but we know we have to get everybody involved.
I mean, it's important to celebrate how far we've come, because we have. Yes. We have. And yet the road ahead is very long and very treacherous. Mm-hmm. And we are currently in a backstep, as mm-hmm. we all know. So, you know, when that first terrible election night, my knee-jerk reaction was, I'm going to lay low, this thing blows over. I better not do Gaytino anymore, you know? And then when I came out of this shock a couple of days later, I thought, no. This is a time not to retreat, but to really stand up and be louder than ever. And we all have to do that. We all have to do what you've been doing forever. You are literally a national treasure, and I treasure our friendship, and I thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Dan, and I want to thank you for all the work that you're doing, because you are also a long-distance runner and carrying on the justice work that your dad started through his music and you through your art. And thank you very much for producing the play Gaetino that I have seen twice and love it. And urge everybody, if you haven't seen it, please, now it's time. And I understand that you're working on some other great projects.
Thank you.
This is Dan Guerrero with the Gaetino Report, and I've been talking with a true American hero, Dolores Huerta. Until next time, ten orgullo, be proud.
And this story is just a reminder of the interconnection of all civil rights struggles.
Don't go away. We'll be right back with musician Holly Lursky.
The Ladder, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. An early magazine created for lesbians in the U.S. was The Ladder. Its first monthly issue was published in San Francisco in October 1956. It contained original literature, news, book reviews, research reports, political commentary, and letters. Founded in 1955, it was published by the first lesbian organization, Daughters of Bilitis. The first editor was Phyllis Lyon, who regularly used the pseudonym Ann Ferguson. In the fourth issue, however, dressed in black, Phyllis Lyon announced the death of her alter ego, Ann Ferguson. Within its pages, Lyon revealed she hadn't been using her real name, but would from then on. The magazine became a lifeline to the lesbian community, with many eyes seeing each issue as it was passed along from hand to hand. After becoming a bi-monthly magazine, it ceased publication with the August-September 1972 issue. This Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and is read by volunteers like me. I'm Dan Roberts.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
The song you heard coming out of break was O Atoms, O Molecules by singer-songwriter Holly Lursky. Starting out with the folk rock band Angelou in the 1990s, Holly has toured with acts like Eddie Reeder, John Hiatt, Jason Mraz, and the Cranberries, along the way catching the ear of music critics and record companies. Holly Lursky has been compared with artists such as Beth Orton and the late Jeff Buckley. She's been a solo artist for over a decade, and her 2015 album, The Wooden House, recorded in her shed, was named by both The Telegraph and independent newspapers in the UK as one of the best folk albums of the year. Holly is far from her home in Norwich, England, and is currently following along the tracks of Jack Kerouac on a rail and road trip through the western U.S. And we're thrilled that one of your stops is our studio for a chat with IMRU. So tell us a little bit about this journey that you're on.
So yes, I'm on a bit of a road trip. Well, I say road, it's a rail really. I started in Chicago, rail to San Francisco, and the idea was just to write some songs really. I find that just getting away from my surroundings where I live, these songs kind of come. It's over two and a half weeks, isn't it? Yeah.
Has the inspiration come? Are you writing new songs?
Yeah, it's been a total surprise, actually. As soon as I got to, well, in fact, as soon as I was on the plane, this song kind of came. And so it finished off being a kind of a Chicago song. Then when I got to San Francisco, this San Francisco song came. And the best one was on Carmel Beach, where literally a song just came, sat on the beach with this gull kind of beside me. So, yeah, it's been a real surprise.
And what surprised you the most?
I suppose that, like anything when you're writing songs, you don't think you're ever going to write another one, and then suddenly a feeling just comes over you, and then the song comes, and you're like, wow, did I always know that?
Aside from the city connections, the place inspiration, has there been a different kind of inspiration than what you'd get at home?
Very, very different. I wanted to be in nature, so I went to Yosemite and I went to Sequoia, and obviously I've been out on very kind of empty roads, and I think definitely I wouldn't have written these songs if I was in England. So I really feel like I've soaked up the landscape and the people and just, yeah.
Is there also a connection to the American music tradition that you're feeling as well?
I've always got that connection anyway. I mean, I'm hugely influenced by it. How can you not be? And even things like how Dylan, he went on his own kind of like odyssey, didn't he? Looking for Woody Guthrie. All that kind of informs, I suppose, why I've done this, really. And I can see why Dylan has such a vivid, rich catalogue.
Why?
Because he's travelling around America. It's an amazing country. Everything is different. I've only been to two states so far on this trip. But even you can go to just different parts of a state and it's different. California is so different. The desert, the woods, you know, it's amazing. The coast, it's incredible, really.
I'm always fascinated by seeing my own home through other people's eyes. And I wonder if you're aware at this point of things that you've seen so far about this country that maybe you'd want to remind Americans of.
Funny enough, when I've been to some of these places, the national parks, and a lot of people are saying, oh, I wish, I've never done that. I'm kind of doing all the things, I suppose, that I imagine you Americans do all the time.
But we don't.
No, and it's just like when I arrived in Watsonville and I'm just sat there and there's two hummingbirds fly down and then the coyotes wake me up in the night. That went into my Carmel song because obviously we don't get coyotes in the night. It's like everything's a bit like something out of a film. And I think the American dream, we're fed it, I guess, just as much through all the films, and it's a beautiful dream. So to actually come here and to see it and it's actually real, it's like, wow.
This trip was inspired in part by Jack Kerouac and his novel Big Sur.
Yeah, so I've always been a bit of a free bird, I suppose. My dad built me my first motorbike when I was 10.
Good lesbian dad.
I know. Well, you know, I helped him in the garage and everything, you know. So I used to go around this aerodrome and just like, there I was, easy rider. And I got the bug for travel. So from then on, I discovered Jack Kerouac when I was about 15 or 16. It was just that thing of just getting out there, the hobo, on the road and exploring. And I've done it ever since, really. And I was lucky enough to do it through touring.
But you're not actually touring on this trip. This is for you.
Yeah, this is for me. And this wasn't going to be a kind of a public thing either. But then I started to think, well, I kind of wanted to share it with people and share the whole experience because it actually might inspire people to get out there and do it as well, you know.
And you're sitting across from me with a guitar, which I think means you're about to share a song with us.
Right, do you want me to start? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so. So, yeah, this is a kind of on a roady song. Country lanes in England, that is.
My love is like a bird that sings, and the sunlight sitting on a songbird's wings. My love is like a summer lane, and first cool burst of a summer rain. My love is like a bird that sings, and the rhythm I'm picking on a songbird strings, and the tune that I can sing all day. Gather your wings and fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away, fly away.
This is Abby Dees, and our guest this week is UK singer-songwriter Holly Lursky, who took a brief detour from her American road trip to our studio to chat about her journey and share a few songs with us. Holly, you've been doing this professionally for about 25 years?
Yeah, I got my deal when I was 27, but I've been doing it since I was 20.
I was thinking back 25 years ago or so, and that was a very different time to be a lesbian in the music business. You could be pigeonholed, for one.
I was.
So, yeah, I want to ask you about the evolution of that, of being out since then. Because now it's more like, oh, yeah, and she's a lesbian, too.
It was hard because our first release came out on a small label. They knew that we had quite a big gay following.
Your band, Angelo.
Yeah, this is Angelo. They made sure that that was in the press release and things like that. So the EP, the Hallelujah EP, came out, and we got a lot of coverage in Diva, which is like the UK mag for lesbians and everybody, which is really lovely that we got all that. But as soon as we had that, from then on, when we released our album and we got a really great review in Mojo, which is like a very well-respected magazine, but the little intro was something like 2/3 lesbian and 1/3 something from Norwich. And that basically described our music. We were 2/3 lesbian. You know,
partly Norwich.
Yeah, great. So from then on, it did affect things. When I was speaking to, say, prospective managers or agents, I remember this manager saying to me, why have you got that in there, you know? And when I eventually did get signed to Sanctuary, somebody said to me, oh, they'd been talking amongst themselves to another publishing company, like, oh, you realise she's a lesbian, don't you? And it was unbelievable. And like you say, now you think, wow, nobody cares. But it was a massive deal. And I do think it totally affected that I didn't actually get as far at that point.
So it ultimately did create a block.
Oh, definitely. definitely.
And you had a pretty big lesbian following.
Yes. It felt like at the time. It feels a long time ago now, but yeah, we did.
So fast forward to today.
So that's a long time ago now. And I had a bit of a break for about 7 years. I can't even think. I was carrying on recording, doing my own stuff, but I had a break from the music industry. Didn't want to be touring or have anything to do with record labels or anything like that. But I started to make my own record in my garden shed. And eventually when I finished it, I thought, actually, I really want to take this out there again, but do it completely on my own label, sort the tour out myself. So that was about 3 years ago that one came out. But I'm feeling, I don't know whether it's an age thing, but I am feeling that when it comes to, say, my sexuality, I never really talked about it very openly. Now I don't really care. In fact, I want to talk about it openly because I think it's a really good thing. Because I know for me, when I was younger, you know, you had Katie Lang, that was it.
Were you aware, or are you still aware, of what it means to someone to hear a performer or see a performer who is out and authentic?
Absolutely, because it still means something to me.
Yeah.
You know?
This is Abby Dees, and we're in studio with singer-songwriter Holly Lursky, and we have time to hear one more song.
Okay, I'm going to play you a one that's not recorded yet. It's quite a sad one. So I wrote this recently when I went on a mini road trip in England, and I went and stayed in something called a shepherd's hut. I don't know, do you know what a shepherd's hut is? Okay, so they're these tiny little caravan-y things on wheels that shepherds used to have. I suppose they'd like wheel them around to, you know, various fields, looking after their sheep, and they just like live in them. So it's really literally a tiny, the size of, I don't know, 12 foot by 8 foot, I don't know. If you went on my Instagram, you can see it. So I took my dog and I just went to try to write these songs. So this song came out. Okay. So this is called Girl in the High Castle. And I might fluff it up because it's quite new. Yeah, see, there you go. Right, okay. I'm with it. Here we go.
TV in the afternoon, nobody to talk to, and the only movements are the hands of a clock. I'll never understand why you've been living in a castle alone. Saturday by 2 a.m. called me 7 times, remember, hey, I know you're scared, but that's okay. Nobody's prepared to be living in a castle. And in the dark as you lie awake, don't forget the baker bakes. You're not alone, so go to sleep, darling, and dream that we are young again. One day soon I'll pen a song, make a mint to buy that little house, a shepherd hut for two. And we can laugh about how our dream came through. We won't be living in a castle alone, no.
Thank you once again. So where are you off to next?
Yeah, I'm heading back so I can go back to Carmel because I just love Carmel. It's so nice. I'm hoping like when I go back there, I'm not going to be like, yeah,
no, it's really
right.
Nice. It's really, really nice, except that a house on the beach costs about $15 million.
Not if you're a seagull, though.
And you can find out more about Holly Lursky and check out her music and her travelogue on Instagram and at her website, hollylursky.com. That's Holly Lursky, LERSKI.com. Welcome back. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones. Okay, that's it for tonight. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and our director of distribution and Sparkle, Vash Bodhi.
Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you're a web designer, social media expert, or just interested in LGBTQI community affairs and would like to volunteer with IMRU, email volunteer@imruradio.org.
A little reminder, you can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org.
You can also listen to our podcast, where we'll start presenting longer interviews and content too bodacious to broadcast.
And if you want to see us, be sure to check out our promos on IMRU Radio Podcast on YouTube.
And our thanks to everyone who supported the KPFK Fund Drive. Your financial assistance keeps the message going.
Good night.